on Vimy. I don't know how anything could have stopped us at Vimy. But remember, this wasn't only the training over the tapes. It wasn't only morale. It was that we had mastered our job.
It takes some time to make an amateur army professional-minded.
It certainly does. Oh, yes.
And don't you think that's the root of it?
I think that's the basis of the whole show. This is a job.
Yeah.
And before you can turn out skilled workmen, they've got to do a lot of training. A lot of training. Here again, I spoke of Colonel Davis. Here was one of the things that he knew. He appreciated that. And he drummed it into us all the time. It's training, 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 training. Not right turn, left turn, shining buttons and so on, but although he was death on that too. But training, training, training. Master that gun, master that gun. And I remember every time that we were out from the line, as Lewis Gun Sergeant, I had classes going all the time on Lewis Guns, even with a bunch of old timers. We used to say that our gunners got so good, you know, that they could disassemble the gun and put it in a scoop shovel and throw it in the air and it would come down assembled and shoot.
Well, all this did pay off, did it not, when it came to Vimy Ridge?
Vimy was an entirely different story. We were an entirely different army than at the Somme. And I suppose that some of the terrible things that happened at the Somme were of some benefit, you know, in turning out of army that we had at Vimy.
Must have been.
Oh, yes. Oh, my, yes. Vimy was, I think Vimy was the high day for the Canadian Corps. And I'm not overlooking the 100 days either and what was achieved then, but this was the first great victory.
Yes, and furthermore, it was the first time the entire Corps had operated
as a Corps altogether. There was one thing I was saying a little while ago about the training of our unit and also its morale. You see, at Vimy, we were to go over on the very left of the front from the Pimple to the right. But a unit or two had been run into tremendously heavy opposition to the South Office on the morning of the 9th. I think my dates are right. Yes. And so we were pulled out from our own front. We went away back, went south to that front, jumped off the following morning, and went over at Hill 145. And the training was so had reached such a high pitch that we were able to go over on that strange ground. And I'm sure there was very short briefing by the OC to the officers sometime during the night. And I can remember him, he was a true soldier. We got out from the music hall trenches and went over some stubble fields way, way behind the ridge in artillery formation, you know, and you could see to the left of us another outfit. Yes. And the OC was walking out in front with his cane, you know, with his head up and his shoulders back and so on. And then we started to go up the slope and broke into extended order. And it was all done just like on parade ground. The training was just perfect. And we went over and took that hill 145 and down on the other side. And then we relieved that night and came back, reorganized. We had some casualties. But this, again, is the result of tremendously good training. Casualties don't hurt as much as they did, for instance, at the Somme. So we reorganized again, and then the next morning, in the snowstorm, went over at our original front. And we'd gone over the tapes for that and knew it like the back of our hand. But what I'm getting at is that with such superb training, we were able to go over on that strange front and do the job that was required, and then come back and go over on our own front as well. This is true. Now, there's one thing I think I should mention. I have stressed training because this is the very basis of success in war.
Yes.
First, appreciation of the job, and then the second, training to do it. But at Vimy, mind you, there had been a tremendously thorough preparation over a long, long time. I can remember on a sunny spring day, it must have been the end of March or the first day or two in April. I can remember somehow or other breaking away from whatever it was we were doing that afternoon and going over a little valley to Herodell Ridge, and the sun was fairly warm, and there was a little corner of a stone fence that was still standing. I sat down there with my back against the stone that the sun was warming and beating down on me, you know, and watching to the south the fire of the artillery. And I remember very well counting the number of seconds that the shell took to go, and the gun boomed until I could see it land on the ridge. Now this was a continuous, persistent process. It was going on all the time. Then the lads in the 10th Machine Gun Company, at that time we had machine gun companies, yes, later battalions, yeah, told me that they were firing up to 300,000 rounds per night per gun, using two or three barrels in a single gun, yeah, a maximum gun. And that they were covering all road, firing by Mach and yes, tonometer, of course, yes, and covering all road junctions and so on. And this was during the 24 hours, not continuously, but at intervals, at frequent intervals, covering all those road junctures. The prisoners who were taken at the Pimple on the second day of attack, yes, said that they hadn't had, and these were Prussian guards, the very cream of the German army, said that they hadn't had food come up for a couple of days. And we always attributed that, of course, to the very effective coverage of artillery and machine gun fire on the worst slope of the ridge. Mm-hmm. So that there was preparation as well as training.
Yes, yes. Well prepared, I guess. And the wire was quite well cut.
The wire was cut. And we went over in the ridge in the Hill 145. I saw something that I wouldn't have believed. The machine gun fire had been so persistent and so heavy that I saw barbed wire that had been blown up by the heavies. The heavies go in the ground, explode, and tear it up, and go up loose, and then fall loose on the ground. And the machine gun fire was so thick and heavy and persistent that I saw balls of it rolled up as big as that chair and beaten as hard as iron. Just rolled up with machine gun fire like that. This is incredible, but it's true nevertheless. I saw that on Hill 145.
Isn't that amazing?
So this had been going on for a long time, and it was very thorough.
Do you remember the prisoners that day? I gather you took quite a few prisoners.
I've forgotten the number, but there were a considerable number, yes. I remember going up to have a look at my guns after the show quietened down a little bit, you know, and go along the line, and meeting a chap by the name of Marr. We called him Frowsy Marr. He's a great lad. And he was in command of a whole bunch of these prisoners coming back. And they naturally looked beaten up, but they were they're pretty fine troops. Mm-hmm. This was particularly true on the second attack. These men were good soldiers, mm-hmm, good troops. Mm-hmm. But our foes are
well. Then did you stay in there that night, or did you come out?
We went down the far side of the ridge on the second day of attack, and came out that same night. An Imperial division came and took over from us, went through us, and went on to attack, I believed, the next morning, and ran into some very, very stiff opposition. This was on a very level plain there, and Lackalot was down ahead of us, and so on, and we didn't take that ground for a long, long time afterward. Long time. But we were relieved that night and came back, and peculiarly enough, we came back to Winnipeg Huts on Herodell Ridge, Notre Dame de Lorette, pardon me. And we were there the next morning, and a peculiar thing was that the next morning I was sleeping, we were all tired, and just flopped down in a great big shed there. And Bruffy, who was our adjutant, Major Bruff, came along to me and said, "Good morning, Mr. Russenholm." And I said, "Thank you very much." He said, "Get Sam Brown and come into the mess." And this was the notification I had that my promotion had
Oh, that's very nice, fight. Sir. That's your commission right on the field, then.
Oh, yes.
What do you recall, sir, of the actual attack on the Pimple?
It was a very well ordered attack. Now here again, there had been tremendous preparation. Immediately behind us, an entire battalion, I think the 102nd, were as a carrying and working party, and I know after I'd gone over my guns and was coming back to find some company headquarters or something, already, right behind us, here were established great dumps of Lewis gun pans and Mills grenades and everything were right up behind us. So again, there was very, very thorough preparation and very fine support, very fine support. About the attack itself, I can remember, I go back to the morning of the 9th first. I remember we were in some dugouts on our side of the ridge. And in the morning, you know, you look at your watch, and in the morning before the barrage to start, we went out and had a look at a barrage when we weren't ourselves involved. And it was just like a continuous sheet of lightning, like a prairie fire, as it were, behind us. And it was utterly dark still, pitch black. And you could hear this tremendous swish of the shells overhead, and then the explosion out front, just a continuous crash along the line. This was the most spectacular fireworks I ever saw or ever hoped to see. If I go to heaven, I'll never see anything like it. That was the morning of the 9th. Well, we were in a very favored position for it because we were some distance up on the slope of the ridge, you see,
yes.
And could look back over Zouave Valley, and then the guns were up on higher ground away to the rear again, you see. And we were in a very favored position. And when those shells started to crash in line on the enemy positions, it was just like fireworks. With, of course, tremendous noise and racket and so on. Well, on the morning that we went over at the Pimple was just a little raise of ground on the very left of our positions on the ridge, on Vimy Ridge.
Now this
the very the left of our position. Now, there was one battalion position further to the left, but it was the very left of our position on Vimy Ridge.
Yeah.
It was to the left of a long string of mine craters that had been blown up over the years and so on. It was a little bit to the left of that. From our position, we used to watch it very carefully. We always had a couple of guns, Lewis guns, trained on it from our front line. And at times, a bunch of our fellows, they'd get a little, this is this old initiative, you know, they'd get a little enthusiastic and they would creep out through the wire and go down to the edge of quite a deep hole that was there, I guess an old mine crater, and the Pimple was right there, just over to the left in front of it. And once in a while, for some reason, you'd find German parties down in this hole. And on two or three occasions at least, maybe more, certainly two or three, my chaps would creep over there and take a loose gun with them and wait until they saw somebody, and then they let fly, and then of course they'd beat back for the front line because immediately the trench mortars would start coming over, you see. But so the Pimple was this raise of ground, and this is the raise of ground on which the Canadian Cross of Sacrifice is raised at the very north end of Vimy Ridge.
This is the tailing off of the ridge,
this
too.
Is the tailing off
this
of the ridge.
This is the end of the ridge.
It's very right. Tailing, the very left of the ridge, yes, the very northern flank.
Could you see Givenchy over the ridge, or was that
no,
sort of out of sight?
No, not in our defensive position, no. You see, he always, the German, always occupied the upper slope. And we were all, this is where he chose to site his defensive positions. And we were down on our slope, but a little lower. And it wasn't until that morning of the 12th, when we got over, that we could see Givenchy and away in the distance lawns. But this is the first time we'd seen it. And as our fellows went ahead, you could see the roads leading out of Lacolotte and Liévin and these towns. And we actually could see the German limbers galloping down these roads to the rear. The attack, I don't think they thought we were going to make it that day, because they didn't seem to be, they seemed to be caught unprepared.
Yes.
And we actually saw them, and of course this was a great sight, a great lift. I spoke about Frowsy Meyer bringing the prisoners back, and when I spoke to him, I said, "Well, how's she going, Frowsy?" And he said, "Oh, if they gave us 20 degrees of frost and a good barrage, we'd go right through to Berlin."
So, the 20 degrees of frost, I presume, was to harden the ground.
To harden the mud, yep. The going was fairly slow, mind you, on the attack on the ridge, but this had been provided for. There were no impossible schedules to keep up, you see.
Yes.
I think it was 3 minutes to 100 yards or something like this, or 5 minutes. There was ample time to make it.
And your artillery support on this occasion, unlike the Somme, was superb.
Superb. Oh, superb. No. And this again, I think we had the Lahore Division behind us, along with others at that time. During that winter, we developed tremendous confidence and reliance on the Lahore Division of Artillery, because they supported us in the raids that went over, you see, that helped to build up the morale. And we have a very soft spot in our heart for that Artillery Division.